From ABC News, this is Perspective. This week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, children abandoned, tens of thousands detained. What does the president of Guatemala have to say about the number of his people arriving at the U.S. southern border?
He's calling for the extradition of those coyotes, smugglers. He wants these coyotes sent to the U.S. and prosecuted under federal charges.
Tulsa's buried truth. Why the little talked about massacre of black Americans in this oil town 100 years ago matters today.
We've been living through this for a long, long time. And for most of these years, people have been telling the story white.
And even if you're vaccinated, does the idea of jumping back into society scare you a bit? Some advice if you're feeling a little socially awkward these days.
You may not shift gears right away, but you will slowly start to more engage, and people may just be more selective in the type of interaction that they want to go to.
All ahead on Perspective. We'll get to COVID and social anxiety, and we'll even tell you in this show what NFTs are and why people are paying millions of dollars for them. But we're going to begin at the border. Some shocking numbers were released by the government this week. The U.S. says more than 170,000 migrants were either arrested or detained trying to enter the U.S. illegally in the month of March. 19,000 of them were unaccompanied minors. Last week, video was released of two little girls, ages 3 and 5, being dropped from atop a 14-foot-tall section of the border wall into the U.S. by human smugglers. This week, we saw a video of a 9-year-old boy walking by himself near the Texas border. ABC's Matt Gutman has that story.
Through the tears, the boy explains he wasn't traveling with his mom or dad. He was abandoned, ditched, in his words, by the migrant group he was traveling with.
No vienes con mami o con papi o con nadie?
Nadie. Yo venía en un grupo que venía de entrega con usted.
Sobbing, the boy telling the agent he was scared of getting robbed, or worse, kidnapped. He was found by authorities and taken to the Child Detention Center in Donna, Texas.
That is hard to hear. But his story is just one of the many we've heard about migrant children and adults making the trip through Mexico to the U.S. southern border. The Biden administration says it's doing everything it can to develop a clearer path to citizenship as it looks to address the wave of migrants entering the country. This week, Vice President Kamala Harris spoke with the president of Mexico to address the critical political challenge. And last week, she spoke with Guatemala's president, Alejandro Giammattai. This week, President Giammattai did his first U.S. television interview with ABC's John Quiñones.
Here in Guatemala, how bad is the situation with people going north?
Well, the situation is complicated. People emigrate because they have no jobs, no home, no health, no education or security. And those are the five factors that effectively cause problems and lead people to leave their countries in search of a dream that is no longer such an American dream. It's a much more complicated dream.
We interviewed some people on the streets of the capital here, and also we've been out in the countryside. So many of them tell us that they don't want to leave Guatemala, but they don't see an economic future here. What would you tell them?
No one abandons their home, their family, or their land on a lark. That is what a tourist does. But people who do it out of need have to find in their country enough guarantees that they will have opportunities. And that is what we have been talking about with Vice President Harris and President Biden, about the need to build walls of prosperity as opposed to the physical walls.
Do you think people have been led to believe that President Biden would be easier on immigrants, especially children?
That was not exactly Biden's message. But they used his message to turn it around and tell people, now is the time, they'll receive you.
The government of this country is one of the most corrupt governments in the entire world. How can the United States be assured that any funding that it gives to Guatemala will go to where it's supposed to go, and that this will stop the people from making dangerous journeys?
First of all, I've been here 14 months. Not a single accusation of corruption has been lodged against me or against any of my ministers, not a single one. Of course, you can tell me that there have been corrupt governments. We haven't been accused of corruption. We need the United States to see us as their partner, more than an ally, to be partners, because we are partners in the same problems. They don't want illegal people over there, and I don't want them to leave. So we have a common problem. Let's solve it together.
So what do you tell those people that I met on the streets about whether they should go or not, who are desperate to go?
I would tell people to have faith.
And John joins me now to talk more about it. What is the president of Guatemala saying about this, since most of those people are coming from that area of El Salvador, Honduras, and Guatemala?
It was the first interview that he's given to the foreign press, the Guatemalan president, Alejandro G. Amatai. And I got to say, he certainly seems genuinely concerned about the number of people leaving his country for the U.S. He admits many of them feel they have no choice but to make the treacherous journey. And he admits to that, saying the economy is tough. He blames it on COVID, on a couple of hurricanes that have hit Central America, and on coyotes who deceive people, the smugglers, into thinking that we have a wide open policy now at the border. But he says he wants to work with Washington. He wants these coyotes sent to the U.S. and prosecuted under federal charges. And he wants to work diplomatically with Washington on a deal that would allow more workers from Guatemala to cross legally into the U.S. on temporary workers' permits. He's also calling for Washington to allow children from Central America who already have families in the U.S. to travel there legally and be reunited with their families.
What about this message? And it sounded to me like he was saying that many people in Guatemala got a mixed message when the Biden White House came in. Not a mixed message, but they misunderstood it. You know, how difficult was that to actually convey to the people of Guatemala that that's not the case?
You got to remember, people in the countryside, especially of Guatemala, don't have television and they don't have the access to the media and social media and computers that we have here. So the message has been slow in getting out there. They do have just regular television in the United States now. While I was down there in Guatemala, we saw commercials that were being sent out saying, no, the border is not open. Don't make this journey. He admits that the coyotes have taken advantage of this and lie to people saying, if you give me $12,000, $15,000, $19,000 for this journey, we will guarantee you that we'll get you across, when they can't, in fact, do that.
You guys have been doing some just phenomenal reporting from the border and keep pressing the Biden administration to say, what are you going to do about this? It seems from those of us watching and listening to the Biden administration, they don't know.
They don't even want to call it a crisis. You know, President Biden will not call it a crisis. Now it's becoming a political crisis for him, because he's caught somewhere in the middle here. He doesn't want to put kids in cages, obviously. He doesn't want to return children back to the border and then let them go there with no one else with them. He's trying this compassionate route, which is getting him in a bit of trouble, because too often the kids are spending too much time in those detention centers.
What is the long-term outlook that you have here? Are you optimistic? Are those at the border optimistic on how this crisis, because it is, ends?
I think we are, as the United States, is going to have to work with these countries, Guatemala and El Salvador and Honduras. And by the way, the president of Guatemala doesn't want to be associated with the other two. You know, he wants to negotiate this deal, not with El Salvador or Honduras, because precisely there is so much more corruption in those countries. But I think we're going to have to bolster the economy, make darn sure that the money that we do provide goes to where it's supposed to be going. And that's where the transparency comes in. And that's where Vice President Harris is determined to hold the presidents of these countries and politicians' feet to the fire. But that's the only solution. We have to convince them somehow that there is hope. And that is what they are in desperate need of in these countries.
John Quiñones, thank you so much for joining us, and really important story. Appreciate it very much.
Of course, a pleasure.
For several weeks now, we have reported on Soul of a Nation, ABC's historic six-part series examining the Black experience in America as told by Black Americans. In this week's episode, ABC's Steve Osunsami focused on something that for years, even people born and raised in Tulsa, Oklahoma, might not have known about. Back in 1921, there was a thriving Black population in the city. Because Black people weren't allowed in many places, in Tulsa, they built their own. In the Greenwood section of the city, there were stores and banks and restaurants. Booker T. Washington even nicknamed it Black Wall Street. Until a white mob ended it all in what was one of the most violent demonstrations of racial unrest in this country's history. As a part of Soul of a Nation, Steve talked with descendants of the survivors, as well as historians and the mayor of Tulsa. And he's also turned it into a podcast for ABC News called Tulsa's Buried Truth. I talked to Steve about the massacre and the role it played in American history and how it still affects residents a century later. Tell us what this part of Tulsa was like back in the early 1920s, 1900s. What was it like?
This part of Tulsa was a 35-block area of families, homes, businesses. And it's on the north side of Tulsa. There are a set of train tracks that divide the north side and the south side. It's really close to downtown, that those train tracks. And on the north side of Tulsa is this neighborhood that's called the Greenwood neighborhood. It was at the time a large neighborhood of Black-owned businesses, restaurants. They had more than one movie theater in this small little area. And because we're talking about a time when the boot of Jim Crow is still on the neck of many Black Americans, it wasn't like the Black people who lived here could go buy shoes at the stores downtown. No. Instead, they bought their shoes, dresses, clothing, food at shops and businesses within this neighborhood. And so what you had with this closed economy was a very successful economy. You had many Black people who did better than many of their white neighbors across the train tracks. And that set up this neighborhood for the confrontation that happened on what we now call Memorial Day weekend of 1921.
What was the impetus for it actually beginning, and what was the spark that set it off?
The spark that set it off was a 19-year-old shoe shiner by the name of Dick Rowland. He was accused of assaulting a white elevator operator. He was working downtown and needed to use the bathroom, the colored bathroom at the time. And as he was running out of the elevator to use the bathroom, the accounts say that he tripped and fell and either grabbed the arm of the elevator operator or accidentally ripped her dress at some location, and she screamed. And a shopkeeper who heard that scream as attempted rape. The shopkeeper called the police, and then that set off the chain of events. And the Greenwood neighborhood was, again, a successful Black neighborhood that Booker T. Washington once called Black Wall Street. And it was a place where Black Americans at the time owned guns. So you had white Americans who owned guns, white men with guns, Black men with guns, who all met at the courthouse where Dick Rowland, this 19-year-old Black shoe shiner, was being held because of this incident. The tensions flared, and all of a sudden, a shot went off. It's not clear who fired the shot. It was a warning shot that was fired in the air. And that then began the bloodshed and the destruction. And the Black men with guns were outnumbered, and they were chased back across the train tracks into Greenwood, Black Wall Street, where over the next 16 hours, the angry white mob burned down their homes, executed people as they were running out of the homes that were on fire, took cars and other belongings of the Black families, and essentially decimated the neighborhood of Greenwood. And people had to run for their lives. And it was, by some estimate, close to 300 Black Americans were killed in this massacre. And many of their bodies have never been found to this day.
Why does the Oklahoma Bureau of Vital Statistics say that only 36 people were killed in that riot when it could be 10 times that?
So Tulsa's white mayor, his name's G.T. Bynum, he tells us this in the podcast, that he doesn't trust the official records because he knew that the white institutions that kept these records were shamed by what happened. And we have historians who we've talked with who tell us that when you go look at the archives, there are often pages missing from newspapers. And so at the time, the government's response was to pretend this didn't happen. And so there were many bodies that never had official records that were buried somewhere. And there wasn't really an accounting of what happened. No one white was charged in the murders or the arson for this incident. The only people who were charged at all were a few Black business owners who were charged with starting a riot. And that's the same government that essentially reported that there were only dozens of people killed. One other little example I'll point out. The National Guard was called in. The governor sent in the National Guard. The National Guard was supposed to be there to protect the victims. But instead, what you see in the archives is you see the National Guard rounding up the Black Americans. It's the Black Americans who have the guns at their back. Meanwhile, the white racists, many of them in Klan uniforms, are going through the homes of these families and stealing, you know, what they can, and then after that, burning those homes to the ground. Even though this happened nearly 100 years ago, they are still dealing with its impacts. And you cannot talk about reconciliation until you tell the truth about the past. We talked to the granddaughter of a survivor. Her name's Joy McConduchy. She says, you know, we've been living through this for a long, long time. And for many of these years, for most of these years, people have been telling the story white. And she says, Steve, when you go back and you tell this story, don't tell it white, tell it right. It means telling the story of these missing bodies, not accepting the numbers that we got from what frankly was a racist government. And then at the same time, put up roadblocks for them to rebuild.
And Steve, finally, the thoughts on rebuilding in the Greenwood section today and gentrifying it. Tell me more about that.
The city of Tulsa is trying to memorialize the deaths that happened. And so the anniversary is coming up this summer, and they're building a new history center that's dedicated to the victims. And a lot of money is going into this history center. In addition to that history center, there is all kinds of new construction going up, hotels and motels. There's a lot of feeling from some of the Black families there that gentrification is forcing them out of their own neighborhoods. But there's also another feeling, which is that all of this money that's going into Greenwood, it doesn't help any of the survivors who are still struggling, that there was a loss of generational wealth that they wish that the people who were putting these millions of dollars into the History Center and all these buildings would instead put it back into the community or even give checks to some of the survivors. So we also talk about this sensitive issue of reparations. And some of them say that, you know, they're not even looking for payments, but they want things that improve the neighborhood or improve the chances of success for their young people. And so there's a lot of talk like that that's happening around this memorial that's coming up. And frankly, a lot of hurt feelings from the Black families that all of this hotel motel stuff, you know, doesn't really change or improve their lives or, in their opinion, memorialize their loved ones.
The podcast is called Tulsa's Buried Truth, and it's part of the Soul of a Nation series. Great stuff. Good to hear you on the radio. We like your audio voice, Steve Osunsami.
Oh, keep it up. Thank you. Thank you. I appreciate it.
If you want to hear more about this story, you can listen to Soul of a Nation, Tulsa's Buried Truth on Spotify, Apple Podcasts, or your favorite podcast platform. And you can stream Soul of a Nation on the ABC app and on Hulu. Coming up next, so you say you've been vaccinated, but you're still scared to go outside? You're not alone. We'll talk about it on Perspective after this.
Hey, I'm Andy Mitchell, a New York Times bestselling author.
And I'm Sabrina Kohlberg, a morning television producer. We're moms of toddlers and best friends of 20 years.
And we both love to talk about being parents, yes, but also pop culture.
So we're combining our two interests by talking to celebrities, writers, and fellow scholars of TV and movies.
Cinema, really.
About what we all can learn from the fictional moms we love to watch.
From ABC Audio and Good Morning America, Pop Culture Moms is out now wherever you listen to podcasts.
The first ever criminal trial of a former president is underway in Manhattan. It's one of potentially four trials facing former President Trump as he makes his third bid for the White House. What do voters think about his culpability, and would a guilty verdict make a difference in the election? I'm Galen Druk, and every Monday and Thursday on the 538 Politics podcast, we break down the latest news from the campaign trail. We sort through the noise and zoom in on what really matters, using data and research as we go. That's 538 Politics every Monday and Thursday, wherever you get your podcasts.
From ABC News, this is Perspective. This week's stories and why they matter. I'm Sherry Preston. Coming up, would you pay $3 million for a tweet? Even the very first tweet? How was it sold? Why was it sold? And what exactly are NFTs? We'll tell you. But first, this week, President Biden announced the United States has administered more than 150 million COVID-19 vaccines in the first 75 days of his administration. It means a shorter wait for those not yet eligible in their states, even though finding an appointment can still be challenging in many places. The president has also said that by April 19th, all American adults will be eligible for a shot. Dr. Bashara Shuker is the Biden administration's vaccine coordinator, who spoke this week to our medical contributor, Dr. Jay Bott, and ABC's Aaron Katursky.
Seems, Doc, we're making good progress getting shots in arms, but that may not be enough to stave off these variants?
Well, there's been a lot of progress over the last many weeks. We've administered as a country more than 165 million doses. This is a big deal, and it is a long journey. So we really need to make sure that we're keeping our guards up.
Can you give us your best estimate of the timeline from there? When will most Americans be vaccinated? And you know, there's a lot of discussion about herd immunity. You know, when do we expect to reach that?
It's hard to really predict when all adults will be vaccinated in this country for many, many factors. So we're pretty confident we're going to have enough supply. The second piece we have to pay attention to would be, are there enough places for people to getting vaccinated? And we know that this is definitely moving in the right directions. There are literally thousands and thousands of community vaccination centers across the country. Tens of thousands of pharmacies by April 19th will be available. And we know that FEMA is also running community vaccination centers in partnership with states. Once we get to the 40,000 retail pharmacy locations activated, about 90% of people in this country will be within 5 miles of a location to getting vaccinated. And then making sure that we do have resources to support with transporting people back and forth if transportation is an issue.
What about, though, when the problem is not access, but confidence or reluctance?
More and more people in this country are getting more and more excited about the vaccine. We have to continue to work on building the confidence in the vaccine. People trust people they know in the communities. So that's why we've launched a COVID community core that's really about building trusted messengers from the community to help deliver the messages to people in the community. We've engaged lots of organizations from the American Medical Association to UNIDOS to NASCAR. We'd want to continue to build that network of trusted messengers.
How do you navigate balancing speed with equity, and you know, what are the barriers to overcome?
Honestly, we do not believe there needs to be a trade-off. It's about making sure vaccine is available to community health centers. There's about 1,385 of those federally qualified health centers across the country. They serve about 30 million people, 60% of whom are racial and ethnic minorities. Make sure they have the vaccines that they need would be a key strategy that would help us reach minority communities. And we know this is already paying off.
That was ABC's Aaron Katursky and Dr. Jay Bott with Dr. Bashara Shuker, the Biden administration's vaccine coordinator. Now, as more and more Americans get the jab, many of us will start resuming our lives as they were prior to the pandemic. Or will we? It won't be easy for a lot of us. Listen to Rhonda Sanford from Queens, New York, and tell us if this sounds like anybody you know.
Every time I go out of the house, I go through such anxiety. I mean, I'm very careful. I sanitize the carts. I do everything the right way. And still, you know, it's very scary out there.
As more Americans get vaccinated and more Americans leave the safety of their homes, more Americans are starting to get a little freaked out about it. Social anxiety, or at least a fear of being socially awkward when we leave our cocoons, is real. We talked about it this week with Dr. Samuel Rothman, a psychiatry resident with Bronx Care Health System. He's also a member of the ABC News Medical Unit. What's the difference between social anxiety and just generally being feeling awkward in social situations? And do you think we all maybe have one or the other right now?
It's likely that there's going to be some level of awkwardness getting back into the routine. The difference between, I guess, social anxiety versus social anxiety disorder, people will react in a different way. If you feel the sense of nervousness, sometimes it can even be beneficial, like if you have to prepare for a test. But if you are so crippled by going into a certain social situation that it causes you to avoid it altogether, that's at the point where it's a disorder.
Do you think it's going to be easier for extroverts who are used to being out and have missed that, or introverts who are kind of like, you know what, I'm good with this?
I think certainly people that are more along the extrovert side of the scale will have an easier time getting back into the swing of things. Whereas people that are more introverted, they may have been happy to have an excuse not to want to go out. Oh, you know, I can't come to such and such an event because there's a global pandemic. And people may just be more selective in the type of interaction that they want to go to. They may not be so quick to overextend themselves, which I feel like was very much in the culture of things pre-pandemic.
Yeah, I found myself actually enjoying watching things on TV with my husband. Like, I never knew that there was Supermarket Sweep available in multiple countries.
It's Supermarket Sweep. And here is our host, David Ruprecht.
And that the Canadian version is really relatively boring compared to the British version. And they're both boring compared to the American version. That's not really something that comes up much at a dinner party.
Yeah, it's funny that you say that. I actually think that a great point of conversation is, you know, what TV show were you binge watching? Or, you know, what did you get into during this time? But I think the takeaway from all of this is that there is no right or wrong way to deal with what is essentially like a global event that is going to be anxiety provoking.
How important is it that we acknowledge our personal stress, and do we need to reveal that to everybody?
I think it would be a little bit liberating and, you know, free. It's something to talk about. You know, I think that these really shouldn't be treated any differently than some of these other common chronic conditions. If people are more willing to have that sort of understanding, I think as a society, we will benefit.
Dr. Rothman, thank you so much for talking to us about getting back out there when the time is right for you. Appreciate it.
Thank you so much for having me.
Remember, the next time you're at a checkout counter and you hear the beep, think of the fun you could have on Supermarket Sweep.
One of the main tenets of the internet is that everything is copyable. There's copy and paste, screenshotting, and of course a whole world of memes being endlessly remixed and replicated too. Recently, some people have been shelling out big money for pieces of the internet that they say can't be copied. And it's got the attention of artists, environmentalists, and the financial world. To find out more about NFTs, ABC's Mike Dubusky fired up the internet and took a trip back to 2011.
Nyan Cat is a short YouTube video that was popular on the internet about 10 years ago. It's a looping animation that depicts a pixelated cat with a Pop-Tart for a body flying through space, leaving a trail of rainbow colors behind it. This song plays on repeat in the background. So far, it just sounds like a piece of weird internet ephemera that came and went, but not so fast. Nyan Cat is back in the news. In February, a version of the meme sold for nearly $600,000, which prompted all kinds of questions like, how do you buy a meme? And perhaps the most urgent question of all, why? Well, it all starts with the letters NFT.
Non-fungible token. All it really means is that it can't be divided, duplicated, subbed one for one.
Daniel Roberts is the editor-in-chief of Decrypt, a cryptocurrency news site. NFTs are digital assets that exist on the blockchain, basically a public ledger for digital transactions. You may have heard blockchain discussed in relation to cryptocurrencies like Bitcoin and Ethereum, but those tokens are replicable or fungible. NFTs, meanwhile, aren't.
Some of them might be one of a small limited batch of 20. Some of them are even just one of one. And you can point to the spot on the blockchain where it is and prove that.
NFTs can take the form of virtually any type of online content. There is, of course, Nyan Cat, but NBA Top Shot is a marketplace that sells basketball highlights as NFTs. Pretty much, if it exists online, you can make an NFT out of it.
In my work, I do try to focus on emphasizing Black narratives.
Jasmine Boykins is a visual artist who goes by the name Black Sneakers. She owns and operates a gallery in North Carolina. Recently, she's been selling her digital art as NFTs. You can go buy her work on NFT platforms like Super Rare, but if you just want to look at it, you can visit her Twitter feed. Critics argue that simply tying a piece of content to the blockchain doesn't give it value, especially when that content is easily accessible elsewhere. Basketball fans can catch highlights on TV. Nyan Cat is still available to watch on YouTube for free. So why spend money on these things? Even Boykins was skeptical at first.
I honestly thought it was a little weird.
Robert says much of the hesitation over NFTs has to do with how we perceive digital value.
I look at a certain Top Shot moment of Jaylen Brown from the Celtics hitting a jumper.
Pull up by Jaylen Brown, and Boston with that takes the lead.
And I say, how could that sell for $100,000? And the answer is that right now, a group of people in the Top Shot marketplace see that as being worth $100,000. The value of any collectible is purely based on what people think.
And even then, it's not for everyone.
That still doesn't mean that you want to buy or own an NFT or see it as emotionally appealing. You really just have to get past the mental hurdle of non-physical ownership.
Boykin says the value of an NFT for her comes from how they help legitimize digital artwork, which in her view has been maligned by the art world.
Because you know you have the whole stigma against digital art, whereas digital art is not as hard or as complex as traditional, even though both mediums can be pretty intense.
NFT art has raked in big money. Digital artist Beeple sold an NFT at auction for over $69 million.
I'm going to Disney World!
The sale represented the third highest amount ever paid to a living artist, behind only Jeff Koons and David Hockney. But there's another problem. NFTs and the underlying blockchain technology have also drawn criticism for how much computer power they require. Brian Kahn is the managing editor at climate site Earther. He's also part of the faculty at Columbia University's Climate School.
There are computers all around the world that are basically racing to sort of create the next block in the chain.
The process allows the technology to remain decentralized and secure, but it also eats up a significant amount of energy.
They basically plug into where the electricity is cheapest. You're getting it from these dirty energy sources, usually. Usually it's coal in developing countries where there are few regulations.
Other, more efficient processes have the potential to cut down on the tech's energy consumption while preserving its security.
A random algorithm says, okay, I've selected machine over in Redding, California, and that machine gets to solve the problem and build the next block on the chain and mine the reward, essentially. So what this does is instead of all these computers wasting energy, it's only one machine at a time doing this.
Kahn says he's optimistic about the future because the sudden popularity of NFTs have thrust the blockchain's environmental shortcomings into the spotlight. Boykins, meanwhile, says she'd be happy to see the blockchain that supports her art become more environmentally friendly, and she has high hopes for NFTs in general.
And probably become the new mainstream way of collecting artwork, I feel.
This song, by the way, is the title track off Kings of Leon's latest LP. Last month, it became the first album ever sold as an NFT. Reporting for Perspective, I'm Mike Dubusky, ABC News.
He was a fair-haired boy, rather like a Viking, with a sharp face and piercing blue eyes. That, according to Robert Lacey's seminal biography, Majesty, is how Queen Elizabeth's longtime governess, Mrs. Crawford, or Croffy as she was called, described Prince Philip of Greece on the day in 1939 when he and then Princess Elizabeth first noticed each other. And nearly a decade after that meeting, in November of 1947, they were married. Prince Philip was 99 when he died on Friday. From the Foreign Desk in London, here's ABC's James Longman.
Prince Philip was a force of nature, the longest-serving consort to a monarch in British history. He may have been born a prince, but it was hardship that Philip first inherited. Descended from both Danish and Greek royalty, his family fled war and revolution in Greece when he was just a baby. At the start of a promising career in the military, Lieutenant Philip Mountbatten met the future queen when she was only a teenager. Forced to renounce his own royal titles for love, they wed in 1947.
He has quite simply been my strength and stay all these years.
In some ways, the original moderniser, it was the Duke who wanted his wife's coronation televised, creating a landmark TV event. At all times, forced to walk two paces behind Elizabeth, but in life, her equal partner. In private, making major family decisions, like where to send their four children to school. He was known at times for his sometimes off-colour jokes in public. Many say the true measure of their marriage was the laughter they shared.
Prince Philip will be remembered as an old-fashioned royal who, above all else, was dedicated to service, the British people, and after decades by her side, his queen.
From someone born into royalty to someone born with practically nothing. Badly abused as a child, Earl Simmons grew up to become rapper DMX. And as we were putting the finishing touches on the show, we learned that after spending a week on life support following a heart attack, he too had died. Def Jam Records called Earl DMX Simmons a brilliant artist and an inspiration to millions around the world. Just after finding out that he had passed away, I talked about the legacy of DMX with ABC reporter Zachary Keesh.
He was somebody that brought energy and strength to his shows, but he was also able to show this level of vulnerability, right? And allow folks to understand the kinds of experiences that were a part of his life that shaped the person who he was. Think of a song like Slippin', right? Slippin', Fallin', I Can't Get Up, he said. And I think it takes real strength to be able to share that his journey wasn't all success, it wasn't all joy. There was pain that was a part of it. And I think that factor, that attribute is one of the things that people will remember about him and his contributions to hip hop for a long, long time.
Next week, we're gonna talk more about this man, Earl Simmons, DMX, and why he mattered so much to so many. From ABC News, this has been Perspective. Thanks for listening. If you want to listen to any of our past shows, you can subscribe to the Perspective podcast. Give us a review if you've got the time. Tell us what you like and what you'd like to hear in the future. You can find it on Apple Podcasts, Spotify, Stitcher, or wherever you listen to your podcasts. You can also find Perspective and other ABC News shows at abcnewspodcasts.com. Perspective is produced by Eric Mollo. For ABC News, I'm Sherry Preston.